Good evening. I'm Jim Zirin. You are watching The Digital Age. Tonight's show is about our mental health care system. In view of the senseless violence at the Washington Navy Yard last week, we are confronted with the question of whether we provide an adequate mental health care safety net. Aaron Alexis, the gunman, was someone who was obviously mentally disturbed. The issue is, and there is heightened public awareness over this question, are we providing enough of a safety net for our mentally ill? And here to discuss this issue with us is a leading psychiatrist. He is Dr. Herbert Pardes. He is the former chief executive of New York Presbyterian Hospital. He's an old friend, and it is my pleasure, Herb, to welcome you back to the program.
The pleasure is mutual, Jim. Always nice to be with you.
Now, let's start with the relationship between mental illness and criminal violence. We saw it in Washington just the other day. Where do we stand with that?
Well, one of the first points to make is that the psychiatrically ill are not responsible for a very large amount of the violence in the country. However, often when they are involved, it is so dramatic that it captures enormous attention, and so devastating in that here we have 12 people killed. Look at how many people were killed in Connecticut. It is terrible. It is horrifying to the whole population. And for the one thing one can say is it draws the issue to public attention. Mental health is usually at the bottom of the priority scale in most considerations of health and medical issues. This kind of thing and some others that are happening currently are making mental health a more lively issue. And so the answer to the question, are we providing an adequate mental health safety net? No, we're not. There are some things that may help, but as we'll talk about, we have a long way to go in fixing major problems within the mental health system.
Well, it's interesting to contrast the situation at Columbine or the situation with in Newtown with Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre, where it wasn't clear that the shooters had sought mental health care or were involved with mental health care. Here we have a guy named Adam Alexis who thought he heard voices, who thought he was being followed, who said he had a blackout before he discharged a gun in a dangerous way on at least two prior occasions. He had sought mental health care at a Veterans Administration hospital, and yet we failed to identify him as a potentially dangerous person. So where is the flaw in our system?
Well, first of all, I would say that an examination has to be made as to why we didn't pick up how sick this man was along the way and how he got so far, how he got into this particular area and was in a position to do so much damage. That deserves a careful consideration because we shouldn't be allowing that. We should have tough enough screening or sophisticated enough screening to pick that up. Second, the frank answer is that we have difficulty in treating certain kinds of people with psychiatric illness. Sometimes they have enough skills to cloak it, although this, I think, was pretty apparent. And so you've got a number of problems. Our treatments are not perfect. We've got to make them better. Our ability to pick it up and screen. The ability to predict violence is very difficult. The main predictor of violence is usually previous violence. Now, in this instance, that should have worked for us because this man had a number of episodes in which he was clearly violent. And so then the question is, what do you do with this person? What's the nature of the treatment? But there's a whole roster of problems that are dramatized by this episode. And the one, if you can try to find any shred of good, I think it's important that these issues be brought to the American public. Most people do not care that much about mental health. If you said to somebody, we have $10 million, where should we put it? Should we put it to research into Alzheimer's, cancer, AIDS, heart disease, or psychiatric illness? I will bet you 90% of the people would say anything but mental illness. because they don't think they're going to get medals. They worry about heart disease, they worry about cancer, but they don't worry about, they also worry about Alzheimer's, but not necessarily about other psychiatric illnesses.
Well, is that the reason, or is there a certain stigma attached to mental illness?
The stigma, right on target. This is a multi-determined problem, and there is stigma, so that it's pervasive. I had a woman who came to see me when I was doing psychiatric care directly, who refused to take her insurance coverage because she was in a company where the people who review the coverage requests were the ones who knew her, and she didn't want to be known as somebody who had psychiatric problems. The number of people who shrink from involvement in mental health one way or another, even donating money, is enormous. The number of people who suffer from mental illness in this country is some 20%. And if you just figure that out, if we're 300 million people, so 60 million people, and if 60 million people suffer, that means the families are also affected. But the number of people who could help and won't because of exactly what you said, the stigma, is enormous.
Aren't there also a number of types of mental illness? There is the person who perhaps is catatonic. There's a person who is perhaps harmless, schizophrenic, but harmless. And there's the person who's intellectually challenged, who really can't care for himself or herself.
Right.
And then you have the violent, paranoid, psychotic, as we saw in Washington. Now, how do you differentiate among all these categories of mental illness, and what kinds of therapies should be directed to each?
Well, that's a very good question. And first of all, the American Psychiatric Association works on something called DSM, which is a listing of the various illnesses, criteria that lead to their diagnosis, and comments on their treatment. And they do the best they can because we are still at a point where we don't as fully understand it as we might. Let's take an illness like schizophrenia. I think, and most experts, other people who are expert in this, think that schizophrenia is not one illness. Schizophrenia is likely many illnesses.
What is meant by schizophrenia?
Schizophrenia means that somebody has a disorder of their thinking. It's not unusual that they will have hallucinations like this man reported, hearing voices, for example. But if you listen to their thinking, it often is illogical. And they often have difficulty in interpersonal situations. But just as I was saying before, they manifest themselves differently. Even those of us who have a cold may have a cold, which our nose may be bothered by one person, in one person, a head in the other person. Schizophrenia shows itself differently. Now, let me just make the point like this. If you think 1,000 years ago that a doctor walked into your house, examined you, and then said with enormous pride and confidence, "I figured out what you've got. You've got fever." At this point, we would say, "He said nothing to you." Mm. Now, schizophrenia, if I say you've got schizophrenia, that doesn't necessarily mean that I know the precise illness you have. Because as we're getting better information, and there are ways of doing this which I can describe, we're going to have not just schizophrenia, but it may be schizophrenia type 1, schizophrenia type 3, 5, 6. And that's probably true of a lot of illness. And the good news is that as we develop techniques for differentiating those subtypes, we will be better able to match treatment to that specific type and therefore have better results. So you said, what are the typical kinds of mental illnesses? Well, the most frequent are depression, which is, with the World Health Organization, has stated that depression is one of the most serious illnesses affecting the function of people throughout the world. You might think, I think throughout the world, I think of hunger, starvation, which are big issues, no question about it. But depression is a big deal. Schizophrenia is another one. Bipolar means some combination of depression and also occasional hypomanic or manic episodes. Anxiety disorders. You mentioned mental retardation. I think you were referring to autism. There's a whole roster, and each one commands a different kind of treatment approach. But I would say the approaches, while much better than they were, you know, 20, 30 years ago, still have a long way to go to give us the kind of results we'd like.
So what's the answer? What sort of reforms would you advocate?
Well, first of all, I would have the most vigorous research program possible. And I'm concerned that with the nation's problems economically, that the cutbacks at the National Institute of Health, the National Mental Health, and the National Institute of Neurological Disease, they're worrisome to me. A second thing that worries me is that the pharma companies are retreating somewhat from central nervous system disease because they found it so difficult to approach. Now, on the one hand, it is difficult to deal with, difficult to find explanations. But on the other hand, when you realize the cost to this country of these illnesses, then you say you've got to be there. Example, it is projected that in 2050, Alzheimer's disease will have a cost of approximately $1 trillion a year. We can't afford that. So what we want is people to do the research, do the work, to find us some answers. And psychiatric illness is the same thing. It is one of the most expensive aspects of our healthcare system. How do we know that? If you hospitalize somebody, treat them, and then discharge them, and you're trying to keep them from coming back into the hospital and costing more, one of the most difficult populations to affect that in is people with psychiatric illness, and particularly people with psychiatric illness who also have a non-psychiatric illness, like diabetes and depression. Very difficult to keep out of the hospital. So there are big costs to the... So having said that, we've got to have the research in order to find better answers. At the same time, we have to have a broad enough system of coverage so that people who have psychiatric problems can get care. Now, what will happen with the Affordable Care Act will be a very large...
Obamacare.
Yeah. A very large number, which obviously a very kind of controversial area. But one thing that it does do is it expands the number of people who are covered. And the number of people is...
And also it provides that there should be no discrimination between physical illness and mental illness.
Right. Very
in
important.
In providing insurance.
Yeah. We call it parity.
Yes.
And you're absolutely right. That's been a key problem. There have been congressional attempts to fix parity, to make psychiatric illness covered in the same way as non-psychiatric illness. But there are still gaps in that. And the ACA, or the Obamacare, will be a way of fixing that because it will provide coverage to a lot of people who do not get care even though they have psychiatric conditions.
It's compounded, isn't it? Because if someone has diabetes and at the same time has mental illness, he's less likely to tend to his insulin injections and the
exactly.
other things a diabetic might need to
foot care,
himself.
Eye care, watch your all kinds of your body. But you make a very good point. One of the most important things of healthcare in general, which I believe is going to be critical in addressing the cost problem, is to get people taking care of themselves better for whatever illness they have and preventing it or keeping it down to a manageable level.
Now, you argue Big Pharma is not doing the research it should into in the area of psychopharmacology. I mean, Big Pharma gave us Prozac, gave us other anti-depression drugs, anti-mental health illness drugs. Is it your argument that they're not doing their job now?
Well, I don't see this as one in which to be critical of pharma. I understand the concerns they have, but I think it becomes the concerns of all of us. The concerns that pharma has is that CNS has proven it to be a difficult area to find appropriate targets to find treatments for.
CNS?
Yeah. CNS.
Central nervous system.
Brain psychiatric problems, et cetera. And so a number of companies, not all, are retreating from it because they say we don't have a good idea as to a way to proceed. However, we got the phenomenon. Let's just talk of ourselves as citizens of this nation. We have these problems. They're terrible in terms of they're a hurt to patients, they're a hurt to families. And in addition, they have an enormous cost item.
Plus the potential danger to the general public.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so what are we going to do? How do we get pharma at the table? How do we get government involved? How do we get all elements of the private sector? Because this is a serious problem. And one of the ironies of this terrible, just horrendous situation with this recent set of killings, which are simply reflect others as well, is that it's forcing it on the to public attention. President Obama had a national...
That's a good fact.
I think so.
Yes.
I think so. He had a national meeting about a month or two ago. He brought people in and he expressed his concern about this. Terrific. Now we've got to figure out what are we going to do about it. And the ACA is one way of helping to an extent. But my feeling is
Obamacare.
Yeah, Obamacare. get rid of all these abbreviations.
Talking initials, our viewers may not understand what you mean.
I plead guilty and we'll try to avoid that. But we should have medical research almost exempted from the ordinary cuts when one has across-the-board cuts. You just can't afford it. Because it's not just psychiatric illness, it's cancer, it's heart disease, it's all the things that plague people and undercut our effectiveness.
What about law enforcement? We've talked about the shortcomings of our mental health care safety net, but doesn't there have to be a heightened awareness on the part of law enforcement as to who might be dangerously and criminally mentally ill?
Absolutely. And I think one should give credit to a lot of law enforcement groups who I think are doing a lot to try to help. I just want to mention one person who impresses me, Judge Lifman, who is down in Florida, is concerned about exactly that point. We've got the jails now loaded with psychiatric patients. And one of the issues is, how does a law enforcement person handle somebody who's blatantly psychiatrically ill and yet causing some kind of public disturbance? And if you can give those people some training in how to handle psychiatric patients, it often goes down better. But you know that the general knowledge in the mental health community is that the largest hospital in the country right now is the L.A. County Jail or the jails in other cities, because the enforcement population, confronted with very few places to send psychiatric patients, winds up putting them into prison. And he's working to try to fix that in Florida. We should be working to try to fix that across the country.
And some of these people aren't dangerous. I mean, Mayor Koch used to round up homeless people because they're sleeping on the street, and he threw them in jail because he couldn't throw them anywhere else.
Well, the bulk of psychiatric patients are not dangerous. The real danger, the people who commit any kind of violence, who are psychiatrically ill, are probably less than 5%.
Yes.
The bulk of people are actually more victimized. When they went into homeless shelters, the psychiatrically ill in the homeless shelters were often preyed upon by criminals in the homeless shelters, and they were victims rather than perpetrators.
Well, let's take the example of Aaron Alexis. He had an arrest record. He had an unsatisfactory employment record in the Navy. He was disciplined a number of times for insubordination, it appears. He was cleared for a license not only to purchase a gun but also to carry a concealed gun. He was cleared for a secret clearance so he could be allowed on a naval base. It seems that someone other than the psychiatric community fell down on the job on this.
Well, there may have been people in a number of parts of the community, but you're absolutely right. It's a very troubling story. First of all, the question is, how does somebody who comes up with that many episodes even stay within the Navy? How did he get into the Navy? And then how did he get a gun? I mean, this goes back to my own feeling is very strong on gun control, and certainly
you think
control.
There should be background checks.
Absolutely.
A background check here would have showed only that he had an arrest record, not a conviction record. And that's the reason they say they dismissed it, because he just had an arrest record. Now, arrest record, it's true, is not the same as a conviction record, but it does show a pattern of antisocial conduct.
I guess my point would be that if you've got enough episodes, you have to learn that people may be psychiatrically ill, may be dangerous, but have enough skills to cover it so that they just pass through. And if you've got enough suspicion, maybe you'd have to do a more exhaustive check just to make sure, because the penalty, if you don't, is as extreme as we see it in this case.
What about civil commitment? Do you favor civil commitment for some individuals who are mentally ill?
Civil commitment meaning what?
Meaning that not that they go to jail necessarily with a criminal charge, but that on a sufficient showing, a certain person might be shown to need a commitment or incarceration, so he won't be a danger rather to himself or to the community.
Well, I think that we've relaxed our laws a little too much in the direction of trying to respect, and we should respect patients' rights, but we may have to re-examine that whole thing. There are a lot of families living very frightened lives because they've got a psychiatrically ill and they know somewhat violent person in their midst, a young teenager of 15 to 20 living with some parents who are a little older and weaker. You never can tell, and things do happen that's terrible to them. There is a program in New York in which we commit people to psychiatric outpatient care, and they've got to respond to it, and the courts have some oversight of that. But I favor a number of different approaches, and just as you said, the psychiatric illnesses are different. For example, there are a lot of people who have serious chronically psychiatric illness. They will have that probably for life. One of the approaches to them is decent housing with some kind of mental health service within the housing sector. I think we're trying to move toward that in New York. We had a wonderful commissioner, Mike Hogan, who was working on these things, unfortunately stepped down recently, but I think the department will continue. But one of the big deals with psychiatrically ill patients is housing. And so having some kind of place where they can stay and having some people help them with some of the most basic elements. What do they do every day? How do they get their money? What's their general health care, et cetera?
So you're moving back. You favor moving back toward institutionalization because starting with the 60s, as you know, there was a trend against institutionalization, both for economic reasons and, I suppose, other reasons. Civil libertarians said that people shouldn't be institutionalized and we shouldn't segregate our mentally ill. And we found that hasn't worked so well. So is there now a counter trend back toward institutionalizing people?
Well, first of all, I lived through that and I was working in that. And I remember when I headed the Kings County Psychiatric Hospital program for some time, a city hospital. And what would happen would be there'd be a state hospital right next door. We found somebody who'd be seriously ill. We'd send them there, and then the person would be discharged in a week, and he'd be right back into the city system.
So
it was a revolving door. So I think that, on the one hand, some aspects of deinstitutionalization were healthy because we have brought a lot of people out of those circumstances and rehabilitated them. On the other hand, I think we went a bit too far. And that's still happening. We're having a reduction in the context of this discussion. Right now, there are places around the country which are reducing their psychiatric facilities. Cedars-Sinai in California just closed their psychiatric unit. Alabama, I think, just closed their state hospital units. Connecticut is closing a major psychiatric unit. So how do you close when the need is so apparent? And often it's a budgetary thing. People felt that they were costly. And they started to put people out. There were a lot of reasons for deinstitutionalization. People felt respect to patients' rights. There were treatments like new pharmaceutical agents that might help. The budgetary issue was another question. And so you're right, it changed. What didn't happen was a sufficient buildup of the community treatment programs in order to take on this population.
So they didn't rechannel the monies that they saved by closing the institutions into mental health care within the community.
Right. It was done, but it wasn't done adequately. I was head of the National Institute of Mental Health from 78 to 84, and we had a program of community mental health centers across the country. And the idea about those centers was you often had hospitals out in the suburbs somewhere, out in the rural setting, to take the psychiatric patients out of the major community. The Community Mental Health Centers program brought it right into the center of the community, so people knew there were mental health services available right in your town. And what we were going to do at that point is we were going to build enough mental health facilities, community mental health centers, to blanket the country. We had the responsibility was something like, I can't remember the exact numbers. I think it was 2,000 centers for about 1,500 patients, and that would come up to 300 million people, which was this projected number we'd have when we needed them. That was good. It was stopped. It was stopped in the late 70s.
So I have a question for you, Dr. Herbert Pardes.
Right.
Are the mentally ill in the United States of America today underserved?
Yes.
Underserved.
They're underserved, we have a number of problems in that regard, and we've got to figure out how to address them. And I'll tell you, on the one hand, we need more people who can provide mental health care. We need better coverage of mental health. We need easier access. And we also have to figure out how to engage more than just the psychiatric providers. And one of the big things we're looking at doing with the American Psychiatric Association is involving general health care people more, other disciplines more to help, because the volume of need is beyond what the psychiatric provider population can provide.
And law enforcement as well.
Law enforcement, too. And we need to work with them because they're important, but many of them do a good job. We'd like them to be even stronger in their sensitivity to dealing with psychiatric patients.
Thank you so much.
It's always nice to be with you, Jim.
I'm sorry that we have to wrap up because it's a fascinating discussion. And thank you for coming by. Tune in next week for more on the digital age. For the digital age, I'm Jim Zirin. Please visit our website at www.digitalage.org. Good night and all the best.